Chapter 22. We rode on in silence, passing the endless mounds of stones and the ruins of homes and businesses. We stopped just outside the city on the coast of the bay. I found little sleep that night, seeing the stone graveyard every time I closed my eyes. Surprisingly, when I did rest, there were no nightmares. When we left at dawn the following morning, I knew the haunting ruins of the city would stay with me for the rest of my life. And as we traveled along Stygian Bay, I feared what awaited us in Spessa's End. With the sun beginning its steady climb, glittering off the midnight bay, the cloaks and gloves became unnecessary. However, with each burnt-out building or dilapidated farm we passed, I was chilled all over again. When Castile caught me staring at some toppled marble columns among the reddish reeds, he asked, "You didn't expect this, did you?" I shook my head. I didn't know it was like this. Actually, I didn't know much about Pompeii or Spessa's End, but I never thought this was the case. I believed the town still existed. So did Victor. He talked about wanting to visit the bay. "So few travel this far out, that there is little risk of the people of Solus ever discovering what was done to the towns or the people. And there's little risk of them discovering what has been rebuilt," Delano added. Eventually, the day gave way to night, and cooler air was ushered back in. The empty fields were replaced by a heavily wooded area that bordered the fields we rode near. I was beginning to wonder if Spessa's End even existed, or where we'd be staying when we reached the other side of the Black Bay, when I heard the soft, lilting call of a songbird. Castile shifted behind me, lifting his head. He mimicked the cry with one of his own. I started to turn to him in surprise when the call was returned. It wasn't songbirds. They were signals. The moment I realized that, I finally saw the signs of a city. Moonlight bathed the sandstone walls of the rise in silver, nowhere near as tall as the ones surrounding the larger cities in Solus. The structure still stretched at least a dozen feet into the air, and I could make out numerous square-shaped parapets spaced several feet apart. Ahead, heavy iron doors shuddered and then groaned, inching open. Torches jutted out from the deep and wide walls of the rise, casting light around the perimeter. The courtyard was mostly left to the shadows, but farther along, light flickered like a staggered sea of low-hanging stars. "Was this not destroyed, or was it rebuilt?" I asked as we rode through the rise.
"The rise suffered some damage, but remained mostly intact. We've been able to repair those sections.
See the lights? That's Stygian Fortress.
It belonged to the caretakers of the bay and was reinforced during the War of Two Kings," Castile explained. "The fortress was largely unscathed, even after the war. I suppose the Ascended were afraid to incur the wrath of Rain by destroying the dwelling, so they left it standing."
"And the caretakers?" I was half afraid to ask.
"They are buried beyond, in stone graves with the rest of the original people of Spessa's End," he answered.
Sick. I truly felt sick. Two entire towns destroyed, and for what? All because the Ascended feared the truth and didn't want to rule so far east? This was a kind of evil, senseless and inconceivable, and I knew that Spessa's End and Pompeii probably weren't the only ones. New Haven would most likely face the same fate, and the only small blessing was that Elijah was moving the people out before they too ended up with only a pile of stones as a marker of the lives they led.
"But we've reclaimed Spessa's End, built back as much as we were able to," Castile said, "and the Ascended have no idea."
"What do you mean?"
"You'll see." Castile's thumb made a sweep along my hip. "I've found a temporary answer to our land issues."
Before I could question further, a form took shape in the road, halting any answers to my questions.
Seti slowed as I tensed, my hand slipping to the dagger on my thigh out of instinct. Castile's hand folded over mine.
He's a friendly.
Sorry, I murmured. Don't be, he said in a low voice.
I'd rather you be prepared than be too trusting.
A torch flamed to life, casting a reddish glow over the face of a young man. He wasn't alone. A wolven stood beside him, a smaller one, with fur the color of the bay. Without warning, the wolven bounded toward us, jumping and prancing about like an excited puppy that recognized visitors.
Someone is happy to see you, Kieran remarked.
Castile chuckled as he tightened Seti's reins.
Careful, Beckett. You don't want to get too close to the horse.
The young wolven danced back as his tail wagged frantically before he wiggled his way toward Delano.
Your Highness,
the young man who held the torch said with a voice pitched with awe. He dropped to one knee, bowing his head, and I was half afraid he'd lose his grip on the torch.
There's no need for that,
Castile said, drawing us closer to the young man. He shifted behind me.
Is that you, Quentin?
The man's head bobbed.
Yes, Your Highness. I mean, my prince. It is I.
Gods, you've grown at least a foot or two since I last saw you.
The smile was evident in Castile's tone, and I almost turned to see it.
Did Alastair drag you out here?
I wanted to go with him,
Quentin answered.
So did Beckett.
Maybe you can tell him to rise.
Kieran rode past the young boy.
The longer he continues to kneel, the larger your ego will grow. I don't know if that's possible,
Nail said under his breath. I raised a brow. Castile laughed.
You can rise, Quentin, and call me Castile like everyone else.
Quentin rose so fast that I had no idea how he didn't light his head on fire in the process. Admiration filled the boyish face. It was too dark for me to make out his eyes as he glanced curiously in my direction.
We've been waiting for you, hoping that you'd make it here tonight.
Where is Alastair?
Castile asked as the wolven trotted between Delano and us.
He's retired for the evening.
Castile snorted.
More like he passed out. He was talking about some whiskey he'd gotten his hands on when I last saw him.
I do believe that the whiskey may have aided in his ability to stay awake,
Quentin answered sheepishly. I grinned, unable to help myself.
But we made sure fires were lit in the rooms, since it does get chilly here at night,
Quentin continued, glancing up at me curiously.
Allow me to introduce my fiancé.
Castile took note of his questioning looks.
This is Penelope.
Fiancé? My grip on the saddle loosened, and I wondered if the dizziness was just my imagination. I didn't think I'd ever get used to hearing him say that.
Alastair said you were bringing a lady with you. Your fiancé.
The torch bobbed along with him.
I mean, congratulations. To you both. You hear that, Beckett? This is our prince's fiancé.
Beckett, the wolven, bounced happily across the road, disappearing into the brush.
Penelope, this is Quentin Delar. The overly excited pup is Beckett Davenwill, a great nephew of Alastair.
Act like yourself. That was what Castile had advised earlier. What would I normally do? Sitting here and staring at the young man as if I had no brain between my ears was not how I'd behave. I would smile and say hello. I could do that. Fixing what I hoped was a normal smile on my face, I gave Quentin a small wave. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's an honor to meet you.
Quentin offered a jaunty wave with the torch in return. The enthusiasm in his voice and greeting softened my smile, and it no longer felt like it was plastered there. I felt rather proud of myself as we passed a copse of trees and the fort came into view. Torches and lanterns warmed the sand-colored stone of the ancient fortress, which rose higher than the rise. Massive columns supported walkways that connected the roof of the stronghold to the rise. Arriving at the stables, Castile demounted with ease and then settled his hands on my hips, lifting me from the saddle. My pulse thrummed as my body slid against his, our heavy cloaks proving to be no real barrier. The hands at my hips tightened. I looked up, his gaze catching mine. For a moment, neither of us moved as we stared at each other. There was an intent in the shape of his lips, one my body seemed to inherently recognize and respond to. I suddenly felt entirely too tight, and yet too loose at the same time. His head tilted, sending my blood pumping. Anticipation was swift and sweet, and I knew I should pull away. We didn't have to be this convincing. But I didn't move. I couldn't. I was snared like a rabbit.
"The rooms are right over here,"
Quentin announced, breaking the spell. Castile turned, grabbing our bags as Quentin headed toward our left. I patted Seti goodnight and then followed Quentin.
"None of the rooms on the upper levels are all that usable, but the ones on the ground level are pretty nice."
He stopped suddenly.
"Oh, one second. Be right back."
Blood still thrumming, I watched Quentin dart through an open doorway into a lit room.
He seems young.
"He just went through the culling,"
Castile explained, and I thought his voice sounded thicker, richer.
"I'm surprised to see him out here," Kieran said, having reappeared. "And that one,"
he nodded behind us,
"especially."
I looked to find Delano leading the horses toward the stables. The small wolven trotted beside him, ears perked as Delano spoke to him, tail wagging frantically.
"Both are far too young,"
Nail joined us.
"I was under the impression that none of the young had moved out here."
"As was I."
Castile squinted.
"The last I saw of Beckett, he could barely control holding one form or the other."
I blinked. "Is that common?" Kieran nodded.
"It takes at least 2 decades for us to gain control over our 2 halves. Any slight change of emotion can send us to 4 legs or 2.
"That has to be inconvenient."
He laughed dryly.
"You have no idea."
"Have Atlanteans relocated to Spessa's End?" I asked. "Is that what you mean by a temporary fix to the land issue?" Castile nodded.
"It hasn't made a huge impact, not yet, but it has freed up some of the homes and land. Those who've moved out here have been hand-selected for the most part, old enough and trained in case the Ascended do happen to venture to these parts, but that hasn't happened since the Ascended laid siege to the town."
"How many people live here now?" I asked.
100, give or take a few."
Irritation pricked me as my gaze swept over the smooth stone facade of the fortress. Why was Castile just now telling me this instead of when he first spoke of the land and the population issue in Atlantia? Or at any point after that? Better yet, why was I irritated that he hadn't? Was this information even necessary for me to know? Probably not. But it still frustrated me. The young Atlantean reappeared carrying a bundle.
"Alistair said that you may be in need of clothing, and we were able to gather some items. I don't know if any of this will be helpful, but it's clean, and I'm sure we'll be able to get you more in the morning."
I took the light bundle. "I'm sure it will be of use, thank you." Quentin beamed before pivoting on his heel. Kieran lingered back as we followed the Atlantean through the covered walkway. He chattered, telling us about the wildlife he'd seen as we passed several dark rooms and then continued around the side of the fortress, where it was evident that no rooms were near. He swore he saw a cave cat, even though Alistair told him that there were none still alive in this area. The first thing I saw was a terrace. Wind caught the pinned curtains, causing the material to snap softly. As Quentin unlocked the door, I was able to make out a chaise longue at one end and several low-to-the-floor chairs. Quentin handed the key over to Castile and then opened the door.
Alistair made sure the room was aired out and a fire lit, since the nights get kind of cold here.
A lamp turned on, casting light throughout the spacious private living quarters, outfitted with plush couches and a dining table.
There are pitchers of fresh water by the fireplace.
Quentin opened another set of doors, and I caught the scent of lemon and vanilla. If the living area had been a surprise, the bedchamber was an utter shock. The fireplace sat in the corner, and as Quentin indicated, several pitchers sat on the floor before it. In the center of the room was a canopied four-poster bed with gauzy white curtains. Across from it were double lattice doors that appeared to lead out to another terrace. On the other side was an entryway to a bathing chamber.
All I could do was stare. If either of you would like, I can get more water for the bath, Quentin offered.
Castile looked to me, and I shook my head. It was far too late for all that work.
That won't be necessary, but thank you.
If you're sure.
When I nodded, Quentin added,
I cannot wait to have a shower, where the only thing I have to do is turn a knob.
Shower? Castile shot me a half grin.
Instead of sitting in the bath, you stand. The clean water comes from the ceiling. It's much like standing in a rain shower, a warm one.
I stared at him. A dimple appeared in his cheek as he turned to the other Atlantean.
She doesn't believe that we have running hot water in Atlantia.
Quentin's eyes grew to the size of small saucers.
He speaks the truth. I've always took it for granted. I will never do that again.
Marveling over the concept of a standing bath that felt like a warm rain shower, I didn't even realize that Quentin had left until Castile spoke.
Are you hungry?
He asked, placing our bags at the foot of the bed. I shook my head, having filled up on the baked bars and nuts Castile had brought with us.
I can't believe these rooms.
I touched one of the curtains on the bed.
They're beautiful.
My father would stay in this one, or the other room that faces the bay when he traveled to Spess's End. Both rooms have been updated as much as possible.
I turned back to him. I expected rooms with the bare necessities.
We eventually plan to fix up the rooms on the second floor. That will allow for more to stay here, while the homes are either being repaired or rebuilt.
His gaze roamed over me. I want to check your arm. It doesn't even hurt, I told him, placing the small bundle of clothing on a settee that sat in the corner near the bed.
Be that as it may, I would still like to see it.
Knowing that he wouldn't let it go, I unhooked my cloak and hung it on a hook near the fireplace, and then pulled up the sleeve of my sweater tunic. I started to tug at the knot, wondering if he'd tied it in a manner that required scissors to remove.
Let me.
He approached me as silently as always. His fingers were warm as they grazed my skin. He had the knot untied in a heartbeat. The bandage slipped away, revealing a thin slash that had stopped bleeding some time ago. His thumb slid over the skin near the wound.
This doesn't hurt,
I swear. I bit the inside of my cheek. It didn't hurt. His touch, nor the area. The smooth swipe of his thumb felt pleasant and shivery. His chest rose with a deep breath, and then he dropped my arm, taking a step back.
I'm going to check in with Quentin and the others. Go ahead and make yourself comfortable. I'm sure you must be tired. Just make sure you clean the wound.
I will. His gaze met mine, and all I could think about was those moments outside after he'd helped me down from Seti. Would he have kissed me? Would I have allowed it? I imagined we would have to kiss in front of people.
Get some rest, Poppy.
Castile was gone before I could even formulate a response, and I knew I should be relieved by that, but I wasn't sure what I was. Turning to the settee, I walked over to the bundle of clothing. There was a thin lilac-hued sleeping robe and a thicker forest green tunic that would definitely come in handy. Unhooking the sheath, I parted the curtain and was greeted by soft furs and a mountain of pillows. "Goodness," I murmured, placing the sheath on the bed. Using only one of the warmed pitchers, I carried it into the adjoining chamber, half afraid Castile would return while I stood naked. I cleaned up as quickly as possible in the much cooler room, making sure to clean out the wound with fresh water and a mint-scented bar of soap. Once I was finished, I slipped on the soft robe, tying the sash around my waist. Digging my brush out of my bag, I undid my braid and worked through the tangles in my hair as I stared at the doorway to the living area. Sometime later, while under the blanket, I wasn't thinking about the Dead Bones clan, the marriage, or what had happened at the keep. I wasn't even thinking about what the sun would reveal about Spessa's end come morning, or how strange it was that Castile had left the room so quickly. I lay there thinking of all those stone graves, burnt out and run down homes in Pompeii, and in the fields between the two cities. If Tawny were here, she would be convinced that spirits roamed the night. I shivered as my eyes drifted shut, wondering how the Ascended had been allowed to grow to this kind of power, where they could destroy entire cities with no recourse. And the only answer was a bitter one. So very few had questioned what the Ascended claimed, and I'd simply accepted what they said, never truly giving life to any of the suspicions I had. That went beyond submission and straight into willful ignorance. Shame slithered through me, another telltale sign that in many small ways I'd been a part of the problem, a spoke in the wheel of the very system that brutalized hundreds of thousands, including myself. The fire must have been fed at some point during the night, because a pleasant heat surrounded my body. I couldn't even remember being this toasty in my bedchamber back in Macedonia. That was my first thought as I slowly came awake. I didn't want to wake up and leave the warmth of the bed, nor the heady scent of dark, lush spice and pine. Snuggling down against the warm, hard bed, a contented sigh escaped me. Wait, the hard bed? That didn't make any sense. The bed had been soft, the kind that you sank into, but now it was warm, hard, and smooth against my cheek and hand. Not only that, the bed was wrapped around my waist, my hip. My eyes flew open. Tiny particles of dust floated in the morning sunlight, seeping through the terrace doors across from the bed. The curtains had been tied back, and I knew I hadn't done that before I fell asleep. And I wasn't lying on the bed, at least not completely. What was under my cheek wasn't a pillow. It was a chest that rose and fell steadily. Beneath my hand wasn't the worn texture of the blanket, but a stomach. The bed wasn't wrapped around me. It was a heavy arm over my waist and a calloused palm against my hip, my bare hip. Oh my gods. I was using Castile as my own personal pillow. And based on the fact that I was lying on him, it was me who had sought him out in my sleep. When had he even returned to the room? Did that matter at the moment? It didn't, as I became aware of every place our bodies met. This was nothing like curling up together while camping on the road. There was no excuse for being all tangled up in him. I lay there frozen, my breath in my throat. My breasts were pressed against the side of his body. One of his thighs was tucked between mine. the soft buckskin of his breeches nestled against a very, very intimate part of me. The robe had parted below the sash in my sleep. There was nothing between his palm and my skin, and that hand spanned my hip, the tips of his fingers resting against the curve of my rear. A sweet, hot feeling swept over me, and my eyes drifted shut. I knew I shouldn't feel this. It was reckless and stupid, and felt oh so dangerous. Instead of basking in how his body felt against mine, I should be plotting a way to somehow extract myself from him without waking him up. But my brain went in a totally different direction. It was almost like I could pretend again that this was okay, that Hawk was holding me in his sleep, and that this was just one of many mornings we woke up like this. He'd kiss me and touch me, fitting our bodies together, and this would happen because we were lovers about to marry for no reason other than the fact that we wanted and desired and needed each other. My breath caught again, and my pulse quickened. Heated lightning danced over my skin and zipped through my veins. I could almost imagine the hand on my hip slipping more to my behind, and then lower still. Those fingers of his were capable of eliciting sensations I hadn't even known were possible, not even after reading the scandalous diary of Miss Willa Collins. My entire world concentrated on the memory of his fingers skimming over the sensitive skin of my inner thighs and then slipping inside me. A throbbing ache settled in my core, and a tiny part of me wished I had never experienced such pleasure at his hands. If I hadn't, I wouldn't want this now. But that was only a small part. The rest couldn't regret experiencing something so powerful and beautiful when I'd spent most of my life being forbidden to know what pleasure felt like. But I shouldn't be thinking about this, about what it had been like for him and me, and how he made me feel even now. Because in the early morning hours when it was just me, I could admit that what he elicited from me went beyond the physical. It didn't seem to matter that I really shouldn't desire any of this, but my body didn't care about what was right and wrong. I still shivered with need as my toes curled. Castile shifted against me, and my heart seemed to stop in my chest. He was asleep, but could he still sense my desire? His arm tightened, pulling me more firmly against him. His thigh pressed against the apex of mine. A shocking, aching pulse ricocheted through me in hot, tight waves. Suddenly, even my brain betrayed me. I was bombarded with images and sensations, the wicked memory of his mouth nuzzling my neck, the slide and scrape of sharp teeth, and the burst of pain that so quickly turned into intense pleasure. There was a wildfire in my blood, pooling in my core. In the furthest reaches of my mind, I knew this was the slippery slope I feared would come with this arrangement of ours. Sharing a bed, pretending to be in love, touching and kissing, pretending I already wasn't slipping down that slope. His arm loosened, but I was still pressed against him, my heart pounding so fast I would be surprised if he didn't feel it. Was he still asleep? Each breath I took scorched my lungs as I carefully lifted my cheek. His head was turned slightly away from me, a tumble of dark waves falling over his forehead. The line of his brow and the curve of his jaw were relaxed. Thick lashes shielded his eyes, and his lips were parted as his chest continued to rise and fall in deep, steady breaths. Unable to look away, I was snared by how peaceful Castile appeared while asleep, how young and vulnerable. Seeing him like this, I never would have guessed that he was over 200 years old, or that he was capable of such feral, deadly action. My gaze drifted over his features, settling on his full mouth. I should have known the first time I saw him that he wasn't mortal. No one looked like him. At least, no one from the Kingdom of Solus, including even the most beautiful Ascended. Why had he wanted me? Why did he still want me? But the night he'd helped replace the panic and fear from the nightmare with something good, something wanted, he hadn't sought any pleasure for himself. Did that mean he didn't want that? From me? Any longer? Those questions didn't come from the niggle of insecurity that I did everything to keep hidden, but simply from pure logic. I knew what half of me looked like. I knew how people saw the other half. Many wouldn't consider me undeniably attractive, even though I had heard people claim that attraction didn't always stem from the physical. But I wasn't sure if that was true. It wasn't like I had a lot of experience with such things. Queen Ileana had once told me that beauty was more than straight, smooth lines, as she showed me the star, a diamond highly coveted throughout the kingdom for its rarity and luminous silver appearance. The most beautiful things in all the kingdom often have jagged and uneven lines, scars which intensify the beauty. In intricate ways our eyes, nor our minds, can detect, or even begin to understand, the queen had said, as she turned the diamond in her hand, light catching on its irregular dips and peaks. Without them, they would just be common and ordinary, like all the other smoothly cut diamonds you can find anywhere you look. Beauty, my sweet child, is often broken and barbed, and always unexpected. I wasn't sure if what she said held true for people. It hadn't seemed that way, because Castile was all smooth, straight lines, and he was magnificent. Why he wanted me, or how he could when there were others with equally smooth, straight lines, didn't matter. What did was the fact that I was staring at him while he slept, and that was borderline creepy. Tugging my gaze away, I bit down on my lip as I decided that this would very much be like ripping a bandage from a wound. I would need to just move, do it fast and well, and hope that he didn't wake until I fixed the stupid robe, or before he realized I was sleeping on him. I started to pull away. Without any warning, Castile moved. There was no time to even respond. He was shockingly fast as he rolled me under him, a hand curled around my throat. I gasped in shock. Castile's eyes were so dilated that only a thin strip of amber shone as his lips peeled back, revealing sharp, slightly elongated fangs. A low, feral growl of warning rumbled out of him and vibrated through me. Castile, I forced out around the hold on my throat. What is wrong with you? The grip on my neck tightened, forcing a harsh breath out of me. Instinct took over, breaking through the coating of surprise as I swung at him with my fist, fully planting it to bring it down on his arm, breaking his hold on me. It never happened. He caught my hand, thrusting it down to the bed. I strained against him, but his hand was like a band of steel. Lifting my head, I sank my fingers into his hair and pulled hard, jerking his head back. Let go of me! The sound that came from him sent goosebumps rushing across my skin as he easily resisted, leveling his head once more. There was no visible amber to his eyes now, and the way he looked at me was like he had no idea who I was. As if he didn't see me. My heart stopped. Something wasn't right. Castile? The only answer was a snarl that reminded me of a very large cornered wild animal as those nearly black eyes moved down the length of me. He didn't seem to recognize his name or me. At once I remembered what he'd told me. He had nightmares, and sometimes when he woke, he didn't know where he was. That had to be what was happening here. I willed my heart to steady.
Castile, it's me.
The rumbling warning came once more. His nostrils flared as he inhaled sharply. Modesty be damned. I didn't care that everything from the waist down was clearly visible because of a nightmare or something else. Whatever was going on, it had a grip on him. I had a horrible suspicion that I was seconds away from turning into breakfast. Remembering the dagger I'd placed under the pillow, I reached behind me, grasping the handle as Castile shifted above me, his hand leaving my throat to curl around my hip. Shock splashed through me as I felt the curve of his chin against my lower stomach. Oh gods, what was he doing? I snatched up the blade, sitting up as far as I could with one hand still pinned to the bed by his. I pressed the dagger against his neck. He seemed completely unaware as warm breath danced lower. Tension clamped down on my chest and coiled even lower. Unexpectedly and crazily, because he was... Oh, gods. It didn't matter what I thought. Neither did the indecent throbbing echoing from within me or the way my entire body seemed to clench tightly as his breath neared the space between my thighs. Another growl came from the back of his throat, this one different, deeper, and coarser. I don't know what is wrong with you, Castile, but you need to let go of me. I put pressure on his throat with the blade, or we will find out what happens to an Atlantean when their throat is cut. That seemed to catch his attention because he stilled and lifted his gaze. Those all-black eyes shook me. I willed my hand to stay steady. I knew if he decided to strike, there'd be very little I could do to stop him. I could make him bleed, if given the chance. Maybe even worse. Get off me, I ordered. Now! He was incredibly still as he stared down at me, like a predator who had sighted its prey and was about to pounce. I tensed as my gift came alive, spilling out from me in the way it did when I was in a crowd of heightened emotions. There was no stopping it. The connection was made, and his feelings rushed through me in a wave of gnawing darkness and insatiable hunger, the kind I had experienced myself on more than one occasion when Duke Tierman was disappointed with something I did or didn't do, and I was denied food until I learned to do better. The longest had been 3 days. And that hunger had been the kind that twisted up the insides in painful need. That wasn't the only thing I felt. Under the feeling of utter emptiness was a lush, dark spice coating my mouth and soaking the banked flames inside me. Castile was hungry. Starving. Was it for blood? He'd said that Atlanteans needed the blood of their own. Had he been feeding? Surely he had. There were Atlanteans here. He'd bitten me a few days ago. He'd drunk from me, but not a lot. I had no idea how potent my blood was, but if it could make vampires, I imagined it held some allure to him. I also had no idea how often an Atlantean needed to feed, but that sumptuous, heavy feeling coursing through the connection sparked a primal sort of knowledge that this wasn't just about satisfying a physical hunger. But under the hunger, I didn't feel any other emotions. The razor-sharp sadness that always cut through him was absent. I didn't know if any part of Castile or even Hawk was inside him now. My heart pounded as I tugged on my left arm, the one still pinned to the bed beside my waist. His grip loosened, and then he let go. But he didn't move. I was overly aware of how close his breath, his mouth, was to the most sensitive part of me, and where I knew a major artery waited. His head turned just the slightest bit, and his chin grazed the crease of my thigh. Several inches lower, closer to the knee, were the gouges in my skin that looked like claw marks, but had been made by the teeth of a craven. I felt none of the horror and fear as I had then, nor the revulsion and certainty of death. All I felt was a delicious ache. The hand that held the knife to his throat trembled as a forbidden pulse of arousal thundered through me. It was wrong, and I shouldn't feel the heat, the dampness gathering there. But it also felt right, so natural, even while none of this seemed natural. He made that sound again, the rolling rumble, and my entire body shuddered. I could barely breathe, let alone think. My senses were firing all at once, and when he dipped his head, my arm went lax, bending to accommodate. My fingers spasmed open, and the knife fell to the bed beside me. "What are you doing? What is wrong with you? What are you?" He gripped my hips with both hands, lifting me, and then his mouth was on me, obliterating the panicky questions. The air left my lungs as his tongue sliced over the very center of me. This wasn't like the last time, the only time. There was no teasing, no slow exploration as he guided me into the wicked act. This time he devoured me, capturing my flesh with his mouth, delving into the warmth and dampness with firm, determined strokes of his tongue. He fed from me as if I were the sweetest nectar, the source of the very life force he needed. I was consumed, crying out as my head kicked back. I was lost in the raw sensations. My body moved of its own accord, or tried to. He held me firmly in place, and there was no matching the sinful assault, no escaping it, even if I wanted to. Fierce heat built inside me, twisting and tightening as everything in me seemed to concentrate on where he was. My back arched as I grasped the sheets fitted to the bed. His lips moved against me, his tongue inside me, and the sharp grays of his teeth scraped the bundle of nerves. The sensation echoed in the healed bite mark on my neck. It was too much. I screamed as I shattered, breaking apart into a thousand satin-garbed shards of pleasure as intense, stunning release rolled through me in undulating waves. I was still trembling when I felt him lift his head. Blinking my eyes open in a daze, I lowered my chin, and what little air had entered my lungs left me. His eyes were pitch black now, no amber to be seen, but they weren't empty and cold like the Ascended's. They were endless and heated, but equally disconcerting to look into. His glistening lips parted. A terrace door swung open, and a gust of wind swept through the room and over the bed as Kieran stormed inside, his hand on the hilt of his sword. He drew up short, brows inching up on his forehead. I had no idea what he could see or how much Castile's body shielded since the curtains had been pulled back. "I heard you scream," Kieran said in way of explanation. "Obviously, I misread the situation." There was no time to feel the burn of mortification. Castile's head swung in Kieran's direction. A violent snarl of warning doused the languid heat in my body. That was a far different sound than what I'd heard from him, even when he first woke. This promised blood-soaked death. "Shit," Kieran muttered, his pale blue gaze widening on the Atlantean.
"Cass, my brother, I warned you this would happen."
I had no idea what Kieran had warned Castile about, but I could see his muscles tensing, preparing. And my gift? Oh gods, my gift was still open, still connected to him. What I felt from him then truly scared me. The acidic sting of anger mingled with a charred taste I was unfamiliar with. But whatever it was bad enough that I feared for Kieran's life. And I wasn't exactly sure when I started to care if the Wolven lived or died, but his death would be, it would be another unnecessary one. I didn't want that. "Castile," I tried, hoping that would garner his attention, and not of the murderous variety. He didn't seem to hear me, his chin dropping even lower as his fingers slid from my hips. Snarling, he bared his fangs. I hope you're listening, Poppy, Kieran said, voice low and unbelievably calm as he let go of the hilt of his sword. When he lunges for me, I need you to run. Go to the area near the stables. It will have double doors. Find Nail or Delano. Get ready.
Get ready? He expected me to run? Besides the fact that I rarely ran for help, I doubted that I could even make it to the door.
Castile, I tried again. And when I felt the power coiling in him, I did the only thing I could think of. Using my gift, I reached out and placed my hand on his arm. I thought of every wonderful feeling I'd ever felt. Walking on the beach with my mother holding one hand and my father holding the other, with Ian dancing in front of us, kicking up sand. I sent that through the connection, through the contact of my flesh to his, using the same technique I did to temporarily give a reprieve from pain. I didn't know why I said what I did next, other than I needed to. It's okay, Hawk. His entire body jerked, as if an invisible hand had grabbed him by his shoulder and pulled. Chest rising and falling in rapid short pants, his back bowed as his hands landed on either side of my hips. He didn't move, not for several long moments, but slowly, through my abilities, I no longer had the charred taste in my mouth, and I felt something under the hunger, a cyclone of shame and sadness. Slowly, he lifted his head and opened his eyes. I let out a ragged breath. They were amber, the only black, his pupils. His gaze met mine, and a long moment stretched out between us. Swallowing thickly, I dropped my hand as he looked down.
Honeydew,
Castile whispered. He grabbed the halves of my robe, tugging it over my hips and my thighs. His hand lingered there, a faint tremor coursing through them as he lifted his gaze to mine once more.
I'm sorry.
And then he rose from the bed and walked out of the terrace doors, past Kieran, without saying another word.